Khachaturian is one of these composers that often surprises me. You know, from where he came from or where we listen to it, I find that his music is timeless. When you listen to this music, George, doesn't it sound like a film score to you?
Film score, or the exoticism, some of that music from the first Spartacus Suite, I think that dreamy piece that has the slow descending chromatic bass line.
Absolutely. This is a wonderful ballet. Unfortunately, I've not seen the ballet myself. I'm not even sure it's done often anymore. But he has created three suites that are very effective. I personally like suite number two the best. It starts off beautifully with this beautiful oboe solo. It's just a gorgeous piece of music, and I find that this is really wonderful music. Khachaturian wrote many beautiful things, like the Masquerade Suite and all these beautiful things. I find it to be wonderful. His film scores, I think, are also ideal. Khachaturian is a really wonderful piece. This ballet, Suite number 2, to me is a collection of some of the finest moments in the ballet. That's why I often do this suite. In particular. So it's a great way to start the performance. It's not such an obscure composer, but it's a piece probably people haven't heard, but I think they'll identify with it, recognize some of the melodies, actually.
Really approachable, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just something you'd be humming and whistling because it's so lyrical and beautiful.
How did Khachaturian get along with the Soviet regimes? I know Prokofiev had a lot of trouble, I think, and Shostakovich did too, if I remember right. How did Khachaturian get along?
You know, Prokofiev was a good son, I think. You know, he wrote a lot of the folklore. He used their music very well. Prokofiev really was in good favor with him.
Yeah.
Shostakovich was a little bit of the bad boy, where he was trying to rebel, trying to be an artist, trying to say something through his music, and that was a little frowned upon, and he was censored quite a bit for a long period in his life. I'm not sure about Khachaturian, how he nestles in there. I tend to think... you might know more about this myself, but I think his music is favorable. And even to the Russians, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
I think so for sure. I think he was easy to get along, easy, like you said, he's easy to listen to. It's beautiful music. He was writing for ballet, which is very important to the Russian people. Even today, the Mariinsky Orchestra in the theater spends a lot of time with ballet. It's a big art form for them. I think it's really great music.
Symphony number 45, Farewell, Joseph Haydn. You know, Haydn really tweaked Prince Esterhazy's nose a bit on this one.
Yeah, this one has a great story to it. Yeah, for sure. You know, out of 104 symphonies, this is why they call him Papa Haydn, because he really had developed and kind of put a niche for himself. But a funny thing, because of his time in Esterhazy as the court composer and conductor, really the music guy there, this was a place that wasn't downtown. This was a little bit off the beaten track, Esterhazy, where he was in this palace with his orchestra and musicians. So he didn't get the chance to hear a lot of other composers during this period, which is interesting because he said himself, it forced him to become more creative on his own, being away from the beaten path and not hearing other musicians, other composers. So he wasn't able to borrow or listen to or get ideas or be inspired by it.
Yeah.
So he's off in this palace having to really put pen to paper and become creative, and really forced him to look inward on these type of things. And this story is just great. This was a great symphony, the Farewell Symphony, that dubbed him himself. This is a bit of an unusual form because he ends it with a slow movement, which is unheard of almost in the symphony format, especially for this time. And this is number 45 for him. I think the story goes something like the musicians had been on a long period of concertizing, and they were coming up onto a vacation. But the prince had asked for a soiree that the night that the orchestra must stay one extra day and play this performance, because that's what they were. It wasn't just for listening pleasure. It was a functional purpose for dinner guests, for after the dinner, or whatever it was.
The house band.
It's really the house band. Exactly right. I mean, what a luxury. Haydn and his great musicians in Esterhazy. So it was super. So they were forced and they were all upset. They were angry that they had to stay. They wanted to go on vacation, but no, they had to stay one more night. What he did was he literally writes places where the instrumentation stops in the score. So the bassoonist is playing along, and all of a sudden there's a double bar, meaning the finish of that bassoon part, in the middle of a phrase. And the bassoonist simply gets up and walks off the stage, or walks out of the palace. And he does that with the horns. He does it with each desk, each stand of the string sections, little by little, so it's very subtle. Now, think of this. The people are probably mingling and talking, and kibitzing and eating and things. And to end the symphony after the big allegro part with a slow movement probably was unnoticeable almost. So that the very subtle disbursement of these musicians gradually leaving the stage, the platform, and sneaking out the back door to begin their vacation early was just genius. So it was written in the score functionally. I'm sure there was some reprimand for this at some point, but he gave his musicians the deserved vacation they wanted, written right into the score.
On the other hand, Haydn probably had more pull than other composers might have had, so he could have gotten away with it. Pictures at an Exhibition.
Oh, wow, what a great piece.
Yeah.
What history, probably one of the most recorded works of all times. You know, we do the Ravel orchestration. Mussorgsky never orchestrated this piece. It's written for piano, of course.
Right.
Which shows that he must have been an incredible pianist himself, because this piece deserves 11 fingers to pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an amazing work. And a great story with his dear friend, who was an artist, Victor Hartmann, who passed away. And Mussorgsky himself physically went to the exhibition to see works as a tribute of Victor Hartmann. And this piece of music is almost a life experience for us listening to it, beginning with the promenade, which is Mussorgsky literally walking through the gallery himself, looking at each work. But it's an odd meter, which means an odd gait. He puts it in 5-4-6-4, 5-4-6-4, 5-4, 3-4, 5-4, 6-4, on and on and on.
Yeah.
Which is not a simple walking pace, like a 4-4, with even beats. It means that there was some walking and stopping and looking and odd meter because of the visualization of being drawn to a work as he's walking in this promenade.
Yeah.
And the promenade happens a few times in the work as we're moving on to different pieces and different things. Ravel's orchestration is probably the most colorful and the most exciting. It's certainly the most popular performed one and recorded today. But there are almost 10, I think there's 10 other orchestrations of this work, and it's fun to listen to the other orchestrations on how these orchestrators are taking the same piece of music from the piano and how they put the colors and the textures. This is a great piece of music. Now the thing is that from moment to moment, the difficulty of this piece is that for the musician, there's not a segue to it. There's no form to the piece. For example, like the Haydn Symphony, where it begins with the allegro, then goes to the slow movement, and we have a simple form for a symphony in that period. This is simply work to work to work. An art piece to an art piece to an art piece. And it changes on a dime, and it's really, really wonderful. So the musician has to capture the essence of what that artwork would have felt like or looked like and portray it in their color and in their texture and their performance. Because it's not all there. We're looking at the notes and the rhythms. But it's important to study almost what we were looking at. For example, the grandeur of the artwork of the Great Gate of Kiev. To see the beautiful domes, that Russian architecture, the size, the magnitude, the strength of that image has to be felt in the last movement of the piece. And the wonderful thing about listening to this, I think, is that it's not important that we actually know what the original artwork was. Because what Mussorgsky's trying to do, in addition to pay tribute to his friend, was trying to give us the experience of what it would have been like to, A, not only look at the images and the sculptures and the paintings and get some sense of what that experience would have been, but it's also trying to tell us who his friend Victor Hartmann was through the music. And that's an even deeper level. So as the audience is listening to this piece at the concert hall, my idea is not to recreate Hartmann's artwork, but my idea is to give the audience an experience along with the symphony simultaneously, the life experience of not only what image does it create in your mind, or what artwork would you create from the music in reverse? Like, what picture do you see, do you feel, what colors, what texture, what mood, what emotion, what passion are you feeling from this specific section or movement? But also the intensity of the music and how does it make you feel?